You're listening to Greater LA, KCRW's show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Once a week at the Central American Resource Center, or CARESN, in MacArthur Park, they take walk-in appointments for legal help. And this place is packed. Many immigrants and their families here today are from all corners of Los Angeles. They are rushing, some in a panic, to try and stay legally in the United States. Now, the time crunch has to do with a new rule change from the Trump administration governing who is eligible for a green card. Alyssa Daubenspeck is managing attorney at CARESN. She's been working on cases that would be affected by that rule change.
They're quite brutal. They really punish people who didn't come from wealthy families.
Under these rules, if an immigration officer determines that you are a strain on public benefits or you're likely to be one in the future, you could become ineligible for permanent residency. Things like Medi-Cal or food stamps, or even if you're just poor or sick and might someday need benefits, forget about getting a green card. This rule change was going to take effect today, but it's been held up by the courts. And even so, it's having a big impact. KCRW's Benjamin Gottlieb met up with a few Angelenos who are worried about what the new rule will mean for them. Here are their stories.
Jose Garcia Barron wants a green card, but there's a problem. Jose is sick.
La diabetes en sí, sino que es las imputaciones que tengo que no me dejan.
The diabetes is one thing, he says, but having toes amputated on his right foot has made it hard for him to walk, to stand, to work. Jose is originally from Chihuahua, Mexico, and even though he's undocumented, he has lived and worked in the U.S. for nearly three decades, mostly in warehouses driving forklifts. But all of that stopped after his diagnosis. I was very depressed. I felt bad, and it was very hard, he says, to go outside. And eventually, he became homeless, sleeping by the LA River. He was on the streets for 6 years. Recently, Jose got placed in supportive housing. Still, he exists in limbo, stuck between a city that wants to protect him and a federal government that's adamant on deporting him. That's why he says he wants to become legit, a legal permanent resident. But under the new rules formulated by the Trump administration, the medical care and housing support that he's getting from local government would disqualify him from getting a green card. He'd be labeled what's known as a public charge. Carla Munoz works at CARESN, and she's been helping Jose with his immigration papers.
I see that a lot with my older clients. If not diabetes, then it might be like, arthritis or dementia because they're older. So just kind of things like that. But I think it's very common in our community.
But it's not just the sick or the elderly that are at risk of missing out on a shot at becoming permanent residents in the United States. So says Alyssa Daubenspeck, CARESN's managing attorney, as she sits behind her desk, which is littered in green card cases.
Well, you know, like a lot of our clients would like to work and they don't have employment authorization, so it becomes difficult for them to get jobs. And so they need to apply for adjustment in order to get that employment authorization. But, you know, because they haven't been able to work, maybe their U.S. citizen children have been on food stamps, maybe they have Medi-Cal, something like that. And so it's all things that sort of create insecurity in the process of applying for adjustment, because if your adjustment gets denied, you get placed in removal proceedings.
In other words, if you apply for a green card and you get rejected, you can actually be deported. It's a big risk if you decide to come forward and then strike out. Among those that are worried about what comes next is Janet Denise. She is a citizen, born in the U.S., but her mother, Rosario, is not. She's from Mexico and is undocumented, complicating her case. Janet is hoping her mother will be given a green card, and soon. She says that's because she's worried the guidelines could change.
It's been since I was a kid, you know, going to see lawyers, getting, you know, not going to the right places or not being informed the right way, the language barrier, all that. So it's just, she's been here for 30 years. That's over half her life. So I'm 28. So my entire life, I've been going through this with them and trying to figure things out. And what do we do now?
What they're working on right now is permanent residency for Rosario. Even though she hasn't been able to work legally in the U.S., Rosario says she's made the best of things.
Cuando yo llegué a este estado, porque he vivido en otros estados, no conocía, y lo único que conocí es trabajar en el fil, en la manzana, en la uva. Fue muy difícil, pero me gustó.
When I came to the state, she says, I worked in the fields, picking apples and grapes, and it was very, very difficult. But I liked it, and I've seen why it's important for people to become documented. There are jobs, she says, and so if people like her are allowed to work, they won't be a public charge. They won't be a drain on society. But the White House disagrees. Here's President Trump at the last State of the Union speech, talking about the cost of undocumented immigrants to American citizens.
Reduced jobs, lower wages, overburdened schools, hospitals that are so crowded you can't get in, increased crime, and a depleted social safety net. Tolerance for illegal immigration is not compassionate. It is actually very cruel.
The president's rhetoric and the threats of policy changes have sparked widespread confusion among immigrant communities, especially when it comes to taking advantage of public benefits. Can they or can't they? Unfortunately, right now, there really isn't a clear answer to that. If the new rules take effect and you've ever used public benefits, it could mess up your chances of getting a green card. But the rules are now tied up in court. Still, it's had a chilling effect, says Nora Adriana Preciado, across the country, including in Los Angeles. She's the director of the Office of Immigrant Affairs for the city.
I'm committed to, along with Mayor Garcetti and every department in the city, to make sure that immigrants and refugees know that they're welcome in the city, that we are doing everything we can to assuage fears. They can access city services and programs without fear, that they can call the police and feel safe about doing that. It benefits all of us to integrate them fully into our city.
Preciado says that's all a lot harder these days, even with the new rule held up in court for now. So far, the Trump administration has been successful in related cases, slashing the number of refugees able to enter the country, restricting asylum, and tightening rules around visas. For KCRW, I'm Benjamin Gottlieb.
Well, just ahead, your tap water may quench your thirst, but there's more, much more than just hydrogen and oxygen in that glass. That's straight ahead on KCRW's Greater LA.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Non-stick frying pans, water-resistant clothing and carpeting, food packaging. There are lots of sources all around us of what are called forever chemicals, commonly known as PFAS or PFAS. They've been created in labs since the 1940s, and as the name suggests, they never go away. In fact, once they get into our bodies, they stay there. And they've been linked to various cancers and thyroid disease. Now they're turning up in the water supply. New tests have found that nearly 300 drinking water wells and other water sources in California have been contaminated with PFAS. But believe it or not, there are no standards for how much of these chemicals is safe. David Jasby is a professor of civil and environmental engineering over at UCLA, where he specializes in water treatment and desalination. Professor, thanks for being with us.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
You bet. What exactly are PFAS or PFAS?
So it's a large class of chemical compounds that have been used very extensively in many, many household and industrial products. anything like you mentioned from, you know, our cookware, our shoes and clothing, all the way to, you know, even like Jiffy Pop popcorn and packaging for food, and also for firefighting foams that people use to put out fuel flames. And they're incredibly widely used, and they're great. They have a lot of industrial, very important industrial uses, but because they're so great, they're also very difficult to break down. So bacteria and fungi and things like that have a really hard time. It's basically impossible for them to break them down. So they just stick around essentially forever.
And we don't know what they do, right? We don't. I mean, we know what uses they have, but we don't know what they do to the human body.
There's some evidence that's starting to emerge that they are linked to certain adverse health effects, like, you know, their cancer and, you know, thyroid disease, like you mentioned. And it certainly seems that mothers and young children are more at risk to this exposure. But there has been no official word out yet about what's safe. So the EPA has a recommended limit, which is 70 nanograms per liter. It's very, very small amounts for two of the particular compounds that are the most widely found. And but that is a recommended level. So even if a utility, for example, detects these, they are not obligated to actually remove them. And in some cases, they're not even obligated to tell the public that it's there.
Which compounds are you talking about?
So this is specifically the perfluorinated octanoic acid, or PFOA, and the perfluorinated octanoic sulfonates, which is PFOS.
It's easy for you to say.
No, it isn't. It's a mouthful.
Well, I mean, so if someone's listening right now and they hear these terms, where do you find this stuff? I mean, if it's in the water supply, obviously, what is it that you're using that has these chemical compounds in it?
So these are legacy chemicals, and they could have been used decades and decades ago, and they just found their way slowly and surely into the water. These compounds act a lot like soap, actually. If you would dissolve them in water, they could foam, some of them. So they like to stay in water, just like soap likes to stay in water. So they'll travel around with water underground, in the groundwater or in surface water. And they don't really stick very well to things, because unless they have very particular characteristics, and they will just stick around. So eventually all things drain into, you know, the bottom layers, in this case, the groundwater.
And if I use one of those filters, like a, you know, a Brita or a Pure filter or something, you know, along those lines, will it filter out these so-called forever chemicals?
Yes. But we have to qualify that, because those Brita filters, or, you know, I don't particularly endorse Brita filters over any other filter, but basically filters that are based off of activated carbon are effective at removing some of these molecules, the larger ones, especially those two that I mentioned earlier, the most prevalent ones, the PFOA and PFOS. Brita filters or any kind of activated carbon filter would be very good at removing those. However, it's really important with those filters to replace them periodically, because they don't destroy them, the compounds. They just kind of suck it up. So eventually their absorption capacity, or their ability to remove these compounds, is diminished over time. So you have to remember to replace your filters.
What do we know, Professor, about testing, the testing of California's water wells and supplies? Should we be concerned about what some of these early tests are showing?
Well, it's a little bit concerning that, you know, 50% of the wells that they looked at turned up positive. That being said, these were wells that were specifically selected because they were suspected of being contaminated. So it's really unclear what the overall picture is. It's probably likely that areas that, you know, exactly like the sampling plan that the state used in order to sample these particular wells, it was done around industrial activities, around wastewater treatment plants, around airports. So places that are probably known to have discharged intentionally or unintentionally these compounds into the air and eventually into the ground. That's why they look there. That being said, because they do move around and because they do persist, they could really be anywhere. However, there's a couple things we need to keep in mind. One, they're really difficult to detect. The concentrations that we're talking about are incredibly small. And it's really only in the last couple decades, maybe even decade, that we came up with the analytical tools that could even find this level of contamination.
Wow.
So that's one thing. The other thing is, that this is actually a big problem. We're not really sure what's out there. We don't even know what kinds of these compounds are out there. I mean, there's thousands that have been identified or hundreds that have been identified. I don't even know how many, but that's certainly not all of them. So the problem with all these analytical tools is that unless you know what you're looking for, it's really hard to find anything. I mean, it's worse than looking for a needle in a haystack. So we first have to understand what's the universe of possibility here, and then we have to go looking for it. But that's going to rely on working with the manufacturers that make these things, and they have to disclose their what they're doing with it and how they're making it. And then we have to go look for it at these incredibly small, low concentrations. It's a real challenge.
I mean, all of this makes sense because, you know, we've heard for years that when you flood, like the water supply has like traces of drugs.
Oh, yeah.
In it, right? Because people flush their medication, pharmaceuticals,
yep,
cocaine, whatever it is down
whatever
the toilet,
yep,
right? And fluoride. I mean, think of all the chemicals that are in the water. So I you know, for somebody who's listening to this, I can imagine that you know, it's like this you know, miasma of terrible information, but it's not all for naught, right? I mean, this is information that you're getting. It doesn't mean you're going to die. It just means you can take some precautions.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, it's all about the kind of risk that we're willing to tolerate as a society. So the EPA works off typically about a risk of 1 in 1,000,000 that you'll get, you know, a cancer or something like that if you consume a compound. If the risk is higher than that, then they'll say, the concentrations have to be below this threshold that leads to a 1 in 1,000,000 chance. But honestly, we all take risks that are every day that are far higher. We get in a car. I drive to work. I'm assuming most people do. The risk there is higher. Some of us decide to smoke. Some of us decide to ride motorcycles. I mean, those are much higher risks. So we have to keep that in mind. There seems to be an increase in illnesses such as cancer and thyroid problems. Is it linked to the water that we're drinking? I'm not sure. I don't think anybody can really say that with 100% certainty. It certainly seems that the more we look, the more stuff we find in our water. The more industrial activities occur around us, the more stuff we find in our water. It just kind of all drains into there. So the utilities actually do a really good job of providing us very clean water for the most part, for the vast majority of cases. Of course, we have tragic events such, like the things that happened in Flint. But for the most part, the tap water in the United States is very safe. I drink it all the time. And I don't feel like it's a particularly big risk. That being said, if you are uncomfortable, if you're worried, especially if you have little kids or you're pregnant or things like that, filter it through a activated carbon filter. It's cheap. It's an easy solution.
As is pretty much everything these days, it's a pretty thick subject. I want to thank you, David Jaspe, professor of civil and environmental engineering over at UCLA. Professor, thank you for your time.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Well, coming up, as metro ridership continues to decline on the buses and the trains, a new report says women feel less safe on public transit in LA. You'll hear about it coming up on Greater LA on the other side of this. The show is called Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Understanding How Women Travel. That's the title of a 169-page report put out recently by LA Metro. The agency's trying to figure out how to improve the experience for women who ride its buses and trains all over Greater LA. And the next step? Creating a gender action plan. Well, one woman who rides Metro a lot, certainly every time she comes to our studio in Santa Monica, is Alyssa Walker, urbanism editor over at Curbed LA, and she's with us right now. Hi, Alyssa.
Hey, Steve.
One big issue that the report identifies and that got a lot of media attention is safety, obviously. What did it find when it comes to safety and women? Particularly, I mean, we're talking about women who ride alone and not necessarily with other people.
This was one of the most obvious things, I think, to myself as a woman who uses the system. 60% of women felt safe using the system during the day, and that goes down to 20% at night. And that tells you a lot about the way the stations are designed, the walking to and from the stations. And also women said that they didn't feel better having, you know, technological solutions like security cameras in the stations. They wanted people there. They want someone they can go to for help or just to answer a question for them if they need to.
Are people there?
No. I mean,
they're not there.
That's a big problem. I think when you go to a lot of these, especially like a subway station late at night, in other countries and other cities, you have a person there at a ticket kiosk or someone who you could at least could go to if you had a question or needed to talk to somebody.
What about lighting?
Lighting isn't as big of an issue going into the subway stations. I would say lighting at bus stops, waiting for the bus in some parts of LA. Literally, there is nothing there. There's just barely a sign. I like to wait by the certain places where I know that there's at least a business that's going to be open late at night, or else I will, you know, go out of my way not to go there at night.
As I said at the top, you use the system a lot. What makes you feel safe and not safe?
Yeah, I've been a regular rider for, you know, more than 15 years. I take my children on it regularly. The worst thing that's happened to me is that my phone got stolen out of my hand on the Blue Line. It wasn't even a violent crime. It's just somebody picked it out of my hand and started running. Yeah, that happens a lot. That's why there's messages that say keep your phones close to you and look at your surroundings. But I was in a situation once where a man was harassing a woman on the platform of the Red Line. And like I said, you call for help. You press that help button. It took over 10 minutes probably for somebody to get down there to help this person. Other passengers tried to, you know, diffuse the situation, but you just don't know what's going to happen. And you're in these underground stations with no one to go to.
What are some of the ideas in the report to help women feel or actually be safer?
I think one thing that is mentioned a lot that I think is the key to this is frequency and reliability. If you know you only have to wait 3 minutes and something, you know, bad starts to happen or you get worried about your safety, knowing the bus will actually come in 3 minutes makes a big difference to how you go about and plan your travel.
And it'll say that on the display, right?
Well, if there's a display. I mean, there's a lot of places there aren't a display. And if you don't have a phone that's equipped to give you the latest information, or sometimes it's incorrect and the bus isn't actually coming.
What does the report say about who the women are who ride Metro?
So one thing we need to think about is that women use transit differently, right? So women are often using it to run household errands. They're often the primary caregivers in their families, and they're often riding with children. I think it said 57% of trips that women take are with children. So you look at the travel and you think of the way that transit planners plan, you know, trips on Metro, and there's a morning rush hour and an evening rush hour, but there's this little bump in the middle of the day for women, and that's moms picking up their kids from school. And so you have to think about, are we increasing frequency during that time of day? Are we making sure there's enough space on buses for moms to take their kids when they're getting home from school? So we really need to think about this idea of what's called trip chaining. So it's a mom going to work, going to school, going to run errands, and doing multiple trips as part of one journey.
Are these folks the people who have to use Metro? I mean, we're talking about cost, right? Where maybe you can't afford a car or you're limited to mass transit.
Right. These are women that may not have options. And for women riders, it's more likely that they will be lower income than male riders on the system right now. So Metro has a very low income pass where it gives people a discount. And a lot of these women surveyed didn't know that this pass existed. They didn't know how to apply for it. And the other thing is, a lot of people don't know what the fares are for children. You can travel with 2 children if you're a paying adult. But at 5 years old, they need their own passes. That's kind of ridiculous, especially if you have multiple children and they each have to have their own tap cards. So one thing that they talked about in the study, which I think is very obvious, is that we should make transit free for all LAUSD students or all student age passengers. And that would eliminate a lot of those problems for parents.
And that's getting more people in transit, right?
Sure,
that's one of the safety issues.
Yeah.
Metro says, Alyssa, that the next step is creating a gender action plan. When can we expect that?
Well, a plan is great, but I don't want to wait for that. A lot of these changes could be made right now. Making transit free for kids right now. That's a very easy thing that can be done. There could be better bus shelters put in place next week across the county. There could be a better stroller policy. This is something I'm always talking about. We need to know that there's a place to put our strollers when we bring them on with our kids. And we need our Metro Board to be riding the trains with moms and with kids to see how bad the problem is now. And we need to fix it, not just to get more people to ride, but in order to make the experience better for people who have to ride it today.
Alyssa Walker, urbanism editor at Curbed LA. Stay safe out there.
I will.
You. All right. Thank you for your time.
You're welcome, Steve.
All right. That's it for today. We're going to shoo on out of here. Funny how high rent can change your perspective about moving back in with the parents. That's tomorrow on Greater LA. Next on KCRW, it's DNA with Francis Anderton. Jenna Cagle, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Christine Comito, and Christian Bordahl, all instrumental in making this show run. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for your ear today and for your time. Have a great day.